Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Maura Sisserman, author of the book The Winter Army, The World War II Odyssey of the 10th Mountain Division, America's Elite Alpine Warriors, published earlier this month by Houghton Mifflin. Dr. Sisserman is a prolific author, penning about 2 scholarly works a year since the early 80s. They all concern fascinating aspects of American history with regard to some of the nooks and crannies of our past, about which we may never have known otherwise. His work regularly appears in the New York Times, The Nation, and other renowned periodicals. The Winter Army is a fascinating tale of pioneering, convincing, and fighting, all related to how the U.S. and the work of just a few men, primarily one who made this happen, and it led to the story of the 10th, the first and only American ski regiment. This led to a military force that scaled peaks, literally and figuratively, which before then no fighting force had ever done, at least an American. In addition to helping in the culmination of our victory over the Axis powers, the regiment went on to fight for us in the 80s and the 90s, and this century. Parenthetically, it also helped to create the organization of one of America's favorite pastimes. So welcome, Maura, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, given the work which you've done and accomplished over the decades, and which we discussed a little bit before the show began, what led you to the discovery of this story, and then your desire to give it to us?
Well, I am coming at this from a different direction than many people who've written about the 10th before me. That is to say, I'm not formally a military historian. I've always been interested in the Second World War. But my 2 previous books have been about the history of mountaineering. Fallen Giants, A History of Himalayan Mountaineering, and Continental Divide, A History of American Mountaineering. And in both books, I stumbled across the history of the 10th because some of America's premier mountaineers in the 1930s, 1940s, joined the 10th or helped develop equipment for the 10th or were otherwise connected to it. So I began reading more about the unit and realized what a unique and powerful story it represented. And so I decided to tackle it myself, coming again from the history of outdoor recreation and exploratory mountaineering.
So when I first heard about the book, to be sophomoric, which is really easy for me, I thought, oh, a bunch of rich guy skiers who want to get on the end of the war and get some glory and then go home and ski some more. So tell me why I am so completely wrong about that conceit.
Well, you're not completely wrong in that skiing was very much an elite avocation in the 1930s. Now, not everybody who skied was wealthy by any means, but people tended to come from backgrounds where they had some, this is the Great Depression, where they had some discretionary income. And many of them learned to ski in colleges or universities on ski teams or through outing clubs. So the 10th was made up of men who had a much higher educational level, if not necessarily an income level, than most of the men who went into, particularly into infantry regiments, which these were. They were mountain infantry. So, for example, the Army issued a standard intelligence test. Every private, upon arriving at a base, would take this test. And if you obtained a score of superior, then you were eligible for officer candidate school. You could go off and become a second lieutenant. And usually about a quarter of the soldiers in a given division would score that high. In the 10th, 2/3 of the soldiers who took the test were qualified to be officers. Now, the interesting thing is, they had volunteered to go in the mountain infantry, and they wanted to stay in the mountain infantry, so very few of them availed themselves of the opportunity to apply for officer candidate school and go off to Fort Benning and then come back as a second lieutenant, because there's only so many second lieutenants that a division can use, and they were afraid they'd become officers and then be sent off to what they called the flatland divisions, you know, the ordinary divisions, and they very much wanted to be mountain troopers.
Well, we'll go back to what a tough job it was for Charles Minot and to begin this whole process, but before we do that, this is what's fascinated me completely about the book is why and how did they accomplish so much in the few short months that were left in the war after they got over there and telling us where they were and what they were doing.
Yeah, as you pointed out earlier, they got in at the very end of the war. That is to say, coming over on several different troop ships, the division arrived at Naples in Italy in December and early January, December 44, January of 1945. The Allied offensive in Italy had stalled out in the fall of 1944. Italy was a very hard place to fight. Winston Churchill had called it the soft underbelly of Europe, but the Allied troops sent to fight there found it anything but, because it's full of mountains. The previous winter, there had been a long and frustrating attempt to break through the German position at Monte Cassino. Finally, in the summer of 1944, there had been a breakthrough through that defensive line, and the Allies had captured Rome, but then they came to another line of mountains, to the northern Apennines, and another German defensive line called the Gothic Line, and once again they were stacked up to it. The Germans controlled the high ground, they controlled the few roads that passed through the northern Apennines from Florence to the south, which the Allies controlled, to Bologna and the Po Valley, which opened up above that mountain range, and they couldn't seem to break through. And so the 10th had been, some of them had been training for 3 years. The 10th is formed in November and December of 1941, just about the time of Pearl Harbor, and they started training in Washington State on Mount Rainier and then at Camp Hale in the Colorado Rockies, and nobody seemed to want them. The Army was suspicious of them. The Army doesn't adapt to change. They'd never had a mountain regiment before. The mountain regiment had smaller artillery pieces, and it had fewer trucks, and it had fewer jeeps because you can't use them in the mountains. They needed to get by on their feet and pack their stuff in on mules. And so finally, they're sent to the front line in February of 1945 in the northern Apennines, and all of that training pays off. They're able to scale a cliff, sheer cliff, on the side of a high ridge line called Riva Ridge that the Germans didn't even bother to guard. They were on top of the ridge. They thought no troops could ever get up that, certainly not carrying all their weapons, maybe a patrol or something, but not a major attacking force. And the 10th scaled the ridge in the middle of the night, in the middle of the winter, and seized the ridge line with only one man wounded. It was a complete and total surprise to the Germans and a complete and total success. And from there, the division went on the next night to storm three mountains linked together, Mount Belvedere, Mount Gorgolesco, and Mount Della Torraccia, and in the next 4 days secured those mountains. Military planners had thought it would take them 2 weeks and maybe 50% casualties, and they certainly took a lot of casualties, but they did it in less than 5 days. So this was a unit that was superbly trained and prepared for the terrain in which they would fight in those mountains.
What made me, it actually just made me sad, is that there were so few men, and I know you said one man wounded, but then, you have over 1,000 casualties, and again, this is after the tide of the war has essentially turned. And so, as I said, and mostly a fallacy, these are people that are, these are soldiers that, for the most part, have some discretionary ability, both monetarily and in terms of their lifestyles, and yet you have these casualties that seem relatively enormous compared to the number of men that were actually deployed. How did that happen?
Well, again, they were all volunteers, and again, many of them could have gone into other units. They could have gone into military intelligence. They could have been in logistics. They could have been in any number of things that their education qualified them to be. Instead, they chose to be riflemen in infantry regiments. They thought they could do the job. They had the training to do it. They were eager to get into war. They couldn't understand all those years of training why the Army didn't recognize their potential. Once they were in the front, they were always in the front for the rest of the campaign. They captured those high ground on Riva Ridge and on Mount Belvedere. Then they pushed against the Germans, and another offensive in mid-April broke out of the northern Apennines into the Po Valley, which is flat and open, and where the Allies had an advantage because they could finally deploy their armor and their air superiority. But the 10th stayed in the front. Even though they were mountain troops, they were now on a plane, but they led the charge. They were the sharp end of the spear. They were the first to cross the Po River. They were the first to reach Lake Garda, which is the gateway to the Alps. And they sealed off at the end of April. They sealed off any possible German retreat from Italy back into Austria across the Brenner Pass. They never failed to take an objective they were given, usually within a day or so, and the Germans never wrested an objective once taken by the 10th back. So they really had an extraordinary combat record. And of course, as you note, it was also extraordinarily costly, nearly 1,000. The division is roughly 15,000 men. Nearly 1,000 of those men were killed, and about 5,000 were wounded in the short time in which they were in combat in Italy.
Do you think that they really, this is going to sound somewhat callous, but do you really think they made a difference?
Sam, you're going to have to ask that again. I didn't get that.
Okay. Thinking about it, and it will sound somewhat callous, do you think they really made a difference?
Well, that's a complicated question. The decisive battle in Europe in the winter and spring of 1945 was taking place in Germany. The Russians, the Red Army, was closing in on Berlin from the east, and the British and the Americans were closing in from the west. The American army crossed the Rhine in March, and after that it was a race into the interior of Germany. So once Berlin was captured, the Russians were in the city by the end of April, the war was going to come to an end. We know that in retrospect. At the time, military planners couldn't assume that. They were afraid that the Germans were going to fight on from the Alps. There was talk about an Alpine redoubt, and crack German SS units were going to put up a last-ditch resistance from the Alps, in which case the 10th's victory and the Allied victory in Italy was of vital importance, again, to keep the body of troops, nearly a quarter million German troops were in Italy, to keep them from crossing the Brenner Pass back to fight that last battle. As it turned out, there was no Alpine redoubt. As it turned out, with Hitler's suicide on April 30th and the Red Army seizing the center of Berlin in the next day or so, that was the end of the war. So was it worthwhile? Again, with the virtue of hindsight, we can say, no, they didn't need to fight that battle. But looking at it from the perspective of 1945, it did seem important.
If we switch a little bit here and pivot to the, what I guess I'll call infrastructure, prior to the deployment and maybe even prior to the attempts to establish this battalion, there were certain techniques that there were certain techniques that were developed in skiing that now your instructor would teach your 10-year-old kid the first couple of days, like the snowplow. So,
right.
So if you could, let's take us through the techniques that were developed in preparation for deployment. And then, as we discussed again briefly before the show, how those techniques and shooting at the same time, which did happen, how those techniques work when you're carrying 100 pounds on your back.
Right. The technique they were trained in had been developed by an Austrian skier named Hannes Schneider, who actually by the end of the 30s was a refugee from Nazism and came to live in New Hampshire, where he had a ski school. And his technique was called the Arlberg technique, which was developed in the Austrian ski resort of Arlberg. And it consisted of a kind of group instruction in a series of turns and maneuvers on the slopes, which every, as you say, every beginning skier learns today, the schussing and the snowplow and so on and so forth, which is very good if you're coming down unencumbered down a mountain slope. It's a little less practical when you have a rucksack of 90 pounds and a rifle strapped on your back and a helmet on your head, because it's easy to lose your balance. And so they actually used a kind of combination of Nordic and Alpine skiing, cross-country skiing, with the kind of skiing you would see at a ski resort, so that they were better able to keep their balance. If you fell, I mean, some of these soldiers are, you know, 110 pounds, 125 pounds. They were smaller generally than people today. And if you have a 90-pound pack on your back, the real struggle was getting up again. And many of their letters home to family during the period of their training sort of either complain about that or joke about being pinned in the snow by this huge amount of equipment they were expected to carry. As it turned out, when they got to Italy, very little skiing was involved for a couple of reasons. One is they didn't bring their ski equipment with them. That was the Army's decision. So they had to scrounge ski equipment for patrols early on before they were fully engaged with the enemy. Secondly, they'd learn how to ski in the Colorado Rockies, where you have this deep powder snow, so your skis go shh, 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 they're quiet. But when you go through the Northern Apennines, where the snow melts and refreezes, it becomes something called corn snow, your skis go scritch, 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 and the enemy hears you coming. And even if it's dark, I mean, they were doing these patrols after dark, they know which way to shoot. So after a few ski patrols, they kind of got rid of the skis. So they were ski troopers, and it was very important to their training, made them very fit, gave them real elan, a sense of themselves as a highly skilled military unit. But the skis themselves were sort of irrelevant to the tasks they were asked to perform. The rock climbing, which they had also been trained in, was of supreme importance in that critical battle, crucial battle to take Riva Ridge. Without that, they probably would not have succeeded.
That answer made me think of one question I had, which I guess is kind of silly, but why was the Olympic biathlon developed? Was it because of all the troops and the Italian troops too in World War II, or was it developed because of?
I don't know the answer to that.
I think it might have been World War I, but I don't know why I think that. But yeah, be that as it may.
That's a good question. I should look that up in case somebody else asks it.
And the second one was what I forgot about was, in your research, the number of letters, the correspondence.
Yeah.
Yeah, talk about that.
Well, one of the things that made this an easy book to write, I mean, it took several years, but there's this tremendous resource for researchers interested in the history of the 10th, which is the 10th Mountain Division Resource Center at Denver Public Library's archives. And it collects hundreds and hundreds of letters, well, really thousands of letters from hundreds of individual veterans of the 10th, letters that they wrote during the war and that their families, who they were writing to, held on to. These were letters they sent from Mount Rainier when they were training there, from Camp Hale, and even from Italy. And obviously it was much more difficult to write from the front line. But still they managed to write, and these are, because who these guys are, they're fascinating letters. They're full of color and information and just a feel for what it was like to go through that kind of training and to fight that kind of war. So I quote from at least 100 different soldiers, although I tended to focus on 10 or 12 who were both the most prolific and whose experiences seemed to me the most representative. But I didn't quite tell the story entirely in their own words, but I could use the words of the soldiers from that moment in their experience to tell the history of the 10th, which I hope will make it an interesting book for readers.
Oh yeah, it definitely comes through, and this I don't mean this to sound condescending towards the rest of our fighting forces, but
no.
These guys were intelligent and they were very articulate, which made the
right.
letters not only more informational but much more personal as well.
Right. And they thought very critically. Again, many of them had been skiers or mountaineers before they joined the service. That's why you had to apply. You had to submit 3 letters attesting to either your skiing ability or your mountaineering ability or some other outdoor experiences that qualified you to be a mountain trooper. And so while they're going through training, they would actually have critiques of their training. Privates would, you know, be discussing with officers what went right and what went wrong in that day's training. I can't think of a single other military unit where that would have been permitted, let alone possible. I mean, if you join the airborne, you're also a volunteer. But it's airborne memoirs, and I've read a number of those, do not have any account of soldiers going through their airborne training critiquing the way they were being trained to jump out of an airplane. Virtually nobody in the airborne had ever jumped out of an airplane before they joined, became paratroopers. But again, a lot of these guys had. So they it's not just that they were well educated, but they had a grounding in this activity, which was a civilian activity, but also becoming a military activity in which they were being instructed.
Yeah, and that reminds me again to underscore it, and what I said in the introduction about like nooks and crannies kind of things. Have you, like, I don't know, if you've talked to people or book clubs yet or audiences, how many people really, I mean, I had no idea, how many people really know that these guys existed and continued?
Well, it depends on what part of the country you're from. In Colorado, where I was doing my research at the Denver Public Library, the 10th are a real presence. That is to say, there's a series of huts named after the 10th in the Rockies, several Colorado museums, the Ski Museum at Vail, the Colorado Historical Museum in Denver have exhibits about the 10th. There are memorials to them at the site of Camp Hale. The camp doesn't exist anymore. And on Tennessee Pass, above the camp where they trained, there's a memorial listing all of their wartime dead. So in that part of the country, and somewhat same extent in the Adirondacks, there are a number of 10th Mountain memorials. So in mountainous parts of the country, people do remember the 10th. I think that's probably less so elsewhere, so you're right about that. The 10th was disbanded in November of 1945, and there were no mountain troops. There was some mountain training over the years at different times and places. But the 10th was recreated in the 1980s, and since then has been the most deployed division in the U.S. Army, because they're trained to fight on rough terrain, they're trained to fight in the cold. They're not ski troops anymore. That aspect of their training has fallen by the wayside. They're a light, what's called a light division, but they still call themselves 10th Mountain. In honor of their predecessors from the Second World War. They're based not far from where I teach at Hamilton College. They're based at Fort Drum, which is in upstate New York near the Canadian border. And from there, they've been sent out many, many times to Iraq and Afghanistan. So people in upstate New York know about the 10th, but again, less so elsewhere.
I was just, you know, this is just off the cuff, I'm just thinking out loud, is I wonder why they weren't reconstituted in the early 50s for involvement in the Korean War. Just seems like that would have been also good terrain, and the weather, which men suffered through, you know, excruciatingly.
Yeah, that's an interesting question, which I also don't know the answer to.
Well, So you took us into the present. You took us into the 2000 with regard to Iraq. So that's one aspect of what their legacy is, that they still are ever upward kind of thing, which is really cool. But what about what they did for skiing in the United States after the war, and why we owe them a debt of gratitude for that?
Yeah, literally thousands of veterans of the 10th were employed by the ski industry in the aftermath of the war, and the ski winter sports in general, and skiing in particular, takes off after World War II. It becomes a mass participation sport in the way it hadn't been beforehand, and that's largely through the efforts of veterans of the 10th who were developing the resorts and developing the ski schools and developing the distribution networks for ski equipment that the new generation of skiers would have the advantage of. For example, Aspen in Colorado, which was about 50 miles away from Camp Hale and where a number of 10th guys would go skiing during the war. I mean, they were training all week on the ski slopes right next to Camp Hale, and then the weekend they'd drive off to Aspen and they'd go skiing. It was mostly a failed mining town, but a couple of the guys who went skiing there recognized its potential, and they went back after the war and developed Aspen into, of course, what it is today, which is one of the premier ski resort communities in the United States. Another 10th veteran who had been employed at Aspen one day in the 1950s climbed a mountainside about 15 or 20 miles away from the site of Camp Hale and looked out, and he saw the potential for what became Vail.
Wow.
So another one of our premier ski resorts, where the longest ski run at Vail, and the most difficult, is called Riva Run, in honor of the 10th's battle on Riva Ridge. And there's a statue of a ski trooper in the center of Vail. So again, the 10th's contribution, both in war and in peace, is very important, and certainly in places like Colorado, it's acknowledged.
I wonder if, and I suppose you do know, is there anybody left? I mean, I know there's a couple of
people. There are a few. I mean, if you do the math, there's not going to be many because these guys are in their mid-90s or older. I had one of the things I liked about going out to Colorado, I went for several summers in a row, and I always timed my visits to the Denver Public Library to the week when the Colorado Veterans and Descendants Organization would have their annual picnic in a park outside of Denver, and I got to meet some of the people I was writing about, Hugh Evans, who was one of the heroes of the Battle of Belvedere, and Gorgolesco won a Silver Star for his actions the day they attacked the mountain, was at two of the reunions I went to, and I got to hear him and some of his buddies singing their bawdy drinking song, which was kind of the divisional anthem, 90 pounds of rucksack, which was a great treat and an honor to meet them. Several of the veterans I met on those Colorado trips have died since I met them just in the last year or so. So as with the World War II generation as a whole, 16 million Americans, men and women, served in the armed forces during the Second World War, and there's probably 100,000 or so of them left, and in 5 years there will be none of them left. Right. So this is really, the closing days of that generation. And one of the reasons the book is coming out now is because this winter and spring will be the 75th anniversary of the 10th signature battles in Italy, and also the 75th anniversary of the closing 6 months of the war in Europe.
So I guess in conclusion, I would ask you, especially since we talked about the Iraq deployment, What do you think? We know what their legacy is, and we know that they've fought in not current but very recent theaters. What do you think lies ahead for them in the future, if anything?
Good question. I mean, the advantage of being a historian is you get to predict the past, you have to predict the future. But, you know, of all the battles, of all the kind of fighting that the United States did in the Second World War, you know, the big battles in France and Germany, landings on Pacific islands and so forth, it's not impossible, but it's hard to imagine that kind of battle being fought in the future. Technology has changed, politics have changed, and military requirements have changed. The kinds of battles that the Army is going to be fighting, I mean, let's hope there are no more battles, but if they're called to do so, will tend to be in remote areas, on rough terrain, sometimes against irregular forces. And, you know, the qualities of a mountain division, or in the current version of the 10th, a light division, are suited for that kind of warfare.
All right. Well, we've been talking with Morris Isserman. The book is The Winter Army, The World War II Odyssey of the 10th Mountain Division, America's Elite Alpine Warriors. As I said, it's been released actually just last week by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And for you guys who've been listening to me for like this past 6 years, it's fascinating. It's something that I bet most of you don't know anything about. And whether you're a nonfiction or a fiction lover, this is the kind of thing that is very, very compelling. And as most of you know, I have an independent bookstore, Wellington Square Bookshop. And I want Morris to know that your book is on the front table, and people really seem to be interested in it. And, you know, most people say you can't judge a book by its cover, but everyone who comes in does. And this cover is a good one, too, so you'll be drawn to it. So, Morris, thanks so much for joining us today, and thanks for teaching us all something about our past and, you know, and a legacy that we might not have known existed.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
We were talking with Morris Isserman, and as I just said, the book is The Winter Army, The World War II Odyssey of the 10th Mountain Division, America's Elite Alpine Warriors. And, yeah, I mean, I like nonfiction. I like fiction more. But the interesting thing about this book is, even though you are learning a lot, because of the personal correspondence that Morris relied on, and because of the elocution and the erudition of the soldiers who wrote home, you really get a very good flavor of what they were going through. And they were going through a lot. And, you know, I'm not saying it's a tragedy, but they were deployed, like I said, right at the end of the war, after the tide had turned and just before Hitler killed himself. So, yeah, you might think, well, what was the point? But the point was, at that time, it's like following through in your golf swing or your baseball swing. They were doing something that was moving us towards a certain place, and they were doing it heroically and at great expense to their life and limb. So I strongly recommend it. I really liked the book. And as always, I ask you to join us every week because my producer, Rebecca, picks these books that somehow ended up being shortlisted for the Booker Prize or the Nobel Prize for Literature or the Pulitzer Prize. I don't know how she does it. But in any event, what we have coming up is one of my favorite authors for young adults is Kate DiCamillo, who's going to join us along with my interlocutor friend, Lorelei, who's 11 years old and will have some good questions, I'm sure. And her latest book is called Beverly Right Here. It's the third in a trilogy regarding Ramey Nightingale and Louisiana, three girls who are wonderful friends who are separated and then joined back together in a lot of different ways, but it's really good. She's one of my heroines, like J.K. Rowling's, because not only are the books wonderful, but it starts you off. And because it starts you off, you go from those books to Catcher in the Rye or War and Peace, all kinds of books, even James Joyce's Ulysses, just like, or Lord of the Rings, which is where J.K. Rowling leads you into. And those are the, you know, those people are amazing, and I have so much respect for them. And then Robin Pogrebin and Kate Kelly will discuss their latest book, which is The Education of Brett Kavanaugh, An Investigation, and you know how I feel about that. So for a complete schedule, you can always visit us at our website at wellingtonsquarebooks.com, or you can simply download our podcasts at iTunes or Podomatic, and you can also download it now at Spotify. And all those links are in our website. So there's lots of ways you can hear us, and I'm very glad for it. So I've enjoyed all these close to 600 authors that I've interviewed. It's been the most fun I've ever had in my life because, you know, the night before you interview them, you hold the soul of the author in your hand, and then I'm lucky enough to actually get to talk to them the next day, having been in their minds the day before, and I have to figure out whether I'm right or wrong, whether I feel cool that I knew what they were talking about or embarrassed because I got it all wrong. So in any event, thanks a lot, and thanks a lot for listening to my long-windedness. And we hope to have you back here next week for another edition of The Avid Reader.